we had reached the 1900s post-Civil War in the United States, and we noted that in the 1900s, there was a serious division that happened within the entirety of the Restoration movement. So we're going to concentrate on what happened in the 1900s. It was reflected ultimately in the religious census in 1906. And then we're going to continue to discuss developments within this movement, some of the developments that we'll be talking about. Some of us have actually lived through, and some of us are aware of those things that may have happened in the past. So let's begin with what was going on in the early 1900s. We talked about this as we were finishing up our discussion of an earlier phase of the Restoration movement. Basically, the movement divided into two major groups. The major groups that emerged from this division that were recognized in the 1906 census for the first time, the movement that eventually resulted in these two groups had been broiling for a long time. It wasn't as if we got to 1906 and suddenly something major happened. This was something that had been going on for a long time, this tension within the Restoration movement. But 1906, the religious census says that there were, at that point, two major divisions within the Restoration movement. Up until 1906, understand that the Restoration movement, the Churches of Christ, Churches and Disciples of Christ, they didn't differentiate between the two. That was the sixth largest religious group in the United States, but it divided. And it's, a lot of people have said that that's kind of the way that things tend to happen. And maybe that's true. And we'll, you know, I sent you an article, and that article that I sent you, talks about how there was a 25-year, 30-year period when everything was going well. People were united. They were pulling people together. And then you hit this kind of a wall and you get division. Anyway, this division, 1906, between the Disciples of Christ, or the group that called themselves, was typically referred to as the Disciples of Christ, and the group that was referred to as the Church of Christ, has now come to fruition. The Disciples of Christ were much larger. That group of the churches was much larger, both in terms of the number of congregations and in terms of the number of members. The Disciples of Christ had, or those that affiliated with I want to call it that wing of the Restoration movement. And that's not really the word that I want, that gravitated to this group that was calling themselves the Disciples of Christ. They had about 75% of the congregations within the entirety of the Restoration movement. They had about 85% of the total membership. By and large, they kept the bigger buildings, the ones that were more elaborate. The Churches of Christ by and large, kept really modest buildings. That's a good way to describe it. And you probably noticed that as you drive around and you're in a strange town and you're looking for a place to worship and you're driving by the different churches and there's a really nice building. And you almost immediately assume, oh, that must be associated with the Disciples of Christ side of this division. And then you find a more modest building that looks really very much more like what we have. And you're going to say, okay, I found the right group. We're not going to have a building like the big building that's on Coburg Road. I can't remember the name of it. But we're going to tend to have more modest buildings. That's not to say that every church that became associated or that stayed with this group that called themselves the Church of Christ, it's not to say that every one of their buildings was a real modest building. I know of several, particularly in Kentucky and Tennessee, where the buildings that they occupied are very elaborate buildings. And some of them are the oldest. In fact, where my sister worships in Kentucky, until they built their new building because they'd outgrown the one that they had, it was the oldest continuously occupied church building in the state of Kentucky. And it was a beautiful building. You know, Ted has seen it. I don't know, Ted, did you ever see the Market Street or the 12th Street building downtown?
Yeah, I saw it.
It's a beautiful building.
Yeah, it's gigantic.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a Norman Rockwell town. You've got the bank on one side of the square and the courthouse is on one of the sides of the square. And this building, the 12th Street building, was on the other side of the square. Faced this beautiful little town square in Bowling Green, Kentucky. So the Disciples of Christ tended to be people with, or people more likely to have, college education. And because they had the college education, they tended to want a college-educated group of preachers or a college-educated clergy. People have looked at the Disciples of Christ, and they say, who are the ideal people that are a part of this group? And it was the businessman. Now, I'm not talking about the wealthy businessman, but the businessman. They tended to be in urban centers, tended to be in the north. Then you had the Church of Christ, for want of a better term, wing of the Restoration Movement. They were predominantly in rural areas, and they were predominantly in the south. Many of them opposed any kind of a professional clergy. In fact, did not want the people that were preaching to have a college degree. And in strange cases, they were opposed to a college education. They opposed any kind of display of wealth, even among people that had wealth. So if you went to a Disciples of Christ group, you would tend to see people in business suits. If you went to a Church of Christ, you would tend to see more people in bib overalls. Their ideal member, and that's a bad way to say it, but these were the members that were held in high regard. They were farmers. And so you have this division that happens in 1906, or that's recognized in 1906. Now, remember, there were about 1,150,000 members in the total restoration movement, but you get this division. I'm not old enough to remember that one. Then within the disciples of Christ, now remember who that was. That's the disciples of Christ, urban in the north, the largest of the groups. Within the disciples of Christ, there pretty quickly developed some tensions even within that group. And those tensions tended to surround at least three big ideas. The first was, how are we going to spread the gospel in places where there aren't churches? And it was within this group that the missionary society, specifically the American Christian Missionary Society, took hold. And at least a part of the disciples of Christ, the Christian church disciples of Christ, wanted to participate in the American Christian Missionary Society. Not all of them did. There were some who wanted to stay independent, and they were opposed to the idea of developing a new institution to do what the church ought to be doing. So that was one of the sources of tension. Another big source of tension within the disciples' wing, and again, I hate that word, but within the disciples' wing of the Restoration Movement, tended to center around biblical criticism, and especially something that's called historical criticism. It's a branch of hermeneutics or criticism, or way of reading the text of the Bible, that tries to understand what the world behind the text was like, and then understand the text as a response to that world. And if the world changes, then God would have been expected to have changed what the text said. So it's opposed to textual criticism. Textual criticism is more like a movement that says, the Bible is inerrant. The Bible is unchanging. The Bible is perfect. We need to just understand what the Bible says. And in many ways, you see that same kind of tension playing out today on the Supreme Court of the United States. You have historical criticism. What did the founding fathers mean when they wrote the Second Amendment, for instance? And then textual criticism, which says, what exactly does the Second Amendment say? So these two ways of understanding text started to play out in the Christian church or the disciples of Christ. And it was as divisive then as it is today with what we call the conservative and liberal wing of the Supreme Court. And then the third aspect of the tension that existed had to do with open membership and open communion. This open communion or closed communion is an idea that dates all the way back to the very beginning of the Restoration Movement and in our country, when they had to figure out, okay, who can be in fellowship with us as we take the Lord's Supper? Now that in my mind is a local decision, but you had a lot of questions that were asked about whether we can have open communion and anybody that wants to take it can take it. It's up to them. Or you have closed communion where it's the responsibility of the person that's serving the Lord's Supper, that's passing the plates, to determine whether or not you are a member in good standing. If you're not a member in good standing, you won't be allowed to participate in communion. Now, again, this is something that this is long-standing tension, and that tension is still playing out today. There are groups who would say that, for instance, President Biden, because of his stance on abortion, cannot participate in the Eucharist in the Catholic Church. The same thing. The Eucharist, I have all kinds of problems with the way that they celebrate the Lord's Supper, but that's their kind of picture of the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist, and whether or not Biden can celebrate that, it would be up to the bishop or the priest in a local congregation to determine if President Biden got in line to come down to the front and take the Eucharist. There are priests who would refuse to offer it to him. So this is a tension. We saw it in the Restoration Movement kind of play out. Remember we talked about the Lunenburg letters, where Alexander Campbell responded to a lady from Lunenburg and talked about the pious unimmersed? So this question has been around for a long time. It's kind of now beginning to come to a head within the Disciples of Christ movement. Then, fast forward to the 1960s. The Disciples of Christ divided within themselves. So remember, here's where we are. We have the Disciples of Christ over here on the left. On let's see, it would be my right, the way I'm pictured on the screen. The Disciples of Christ over here. Well, within the Disciples of Christ movement, there was a division. And that division resulted in two groups. One became known as the Christian Church, parenthetically, Disciples of Christ. That was the larger of the two groups. And then there was a smaller group that was called the Unaffiliated Christian Church, or Church of Christ. So understand, the names kind of get confusing, and there's a lot of reason for people to be confused when they see a Christian church, Church of Christ, and they try to differentiate it from the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, and the names cause all kinds of confusion. Okay, that's what happened in the Disciples of Christ. I have to tell you, I am not as familiar with the thought processes within that wing of the Restoration Movement, because that's not where I am. Now, I do read things that are written from that perspective. But I have to be honest with you, I don't understand everything about this as well as I understand what we're gonna discuss next. Have any of you had experience with these groups that you're familiar with? If you have, raise your hand and you'll get to be the expert on that side of what went on in the Restoration Movement. Remember, This was the lion's share of the congregations and the membership, 75% of the congregations, about 85% of the membership was in this wing. Next, we'll talk about what happened with the Church of Christ, Churches of Christ, which was the other side or the other wing back in 1906. Smaller, tended to be rural, tended to be in the South. Well, this group went through a development process as well. There was a stress on congregational church government, which is probably a reaction to the focus in the disciples' side on cooperation through the American Christian Missionary Society, for instance. So you had a stress over here on congregational church government. And this is kind of where we are. We answer to no one. The elders here make decisions for the group here. They don't make decisions for the group in South Salem or the group at Market Street or the group at Roseburg. They know people there. They talk to people there, but they don't make decisions for people there. And nobody makes decisions and hands them down to us. And that was a problem with the growth of institutions. The institutions kind of took on a life of their own. The American Christian Missionary Society, for instance, took on a life of its own, and it dictated to churches what they were supposed to do. Well, this side of the split in 1906 lays heavy stress on congregational church government. But even within this group, there was still tension. One side of the argument, or one side of the tension, said, yes, we cannot allow the development of other institutions than the church to supplant the church. We can still cooperate, but their method of cooperation was what became known as a sponsoring church arrangement. We're not going to create an institution. We're going to designate a particular congregation through its eldership that will form the umbrella through which we can cooperate. So if we're going to send funds, and we know that there are other people who want to send funds to help to support a preacher who's preaching in the Philippines, we agree that we will be his sponsoring church. We will oversee his activities, and other churches can send us money that we will use to support that preacher on their behalf. So we've avoided creating an institution. It's still within the confines of the church, but we have one church that takes a leadership role. They're the sponsoring church. And that was the response within congregational church government to the methodology that allowed for cooperative effort. So within this side of the restoration movement, you have a great deal of inter and intra inter-church variability. And when I talk about inter-church variability, not everybody that worships in a particular place agrees wholeheartedly and would suggest that they know exactly the only way that things ought to be done. So you'll have a wide variation in people's understanding of how to go about practicing what Christianity is. And then because you don't have any overarching kind of organization, you have a lot of distinction or a lot of variability between congregations. And they accept that there's variability between the congregations. We may do it one way, you may do it another way. We participate in the Lord's Supper using the individual containers, and there are some people who suggest that we should not use those individual containers, that somehow is a violation of biblical precedent, because that was not something that they ever did in the first century. And you will have variability between different congregations. And because of a lot of things that happened with COVID, you had some churches that said, we will not close our doors. And you had other churches who said, we will still continue to worship. We'll find a way to worship together, not necessarily in the building, but we're still going to try to respect what the government tells us is the best way to approach COVID. So within this side, there's a great deal of within churches. No, let me say it again. A great deal of variability between congregations, and a great deal of variability even within congregations. That's intra. So inter is between, intra is within. And that variability is troublesome to some. There are people that really want somebody to step up and say, this is the way that it ought to be. And there have been influential preachers that were willing to step up and say, this is the way it will be. So, about the 1960s, interestingly, about the same time that the division was taking place over on the other side in the disciples movement, you get division that starts to make itself felt within the churches of Christ. And it seems like it always works this way. There was the mainstream group that was about 80% of the membership and about 80% of the congregation and about 80% of the assets that the Christians could bring to bear on a particular issue. They shared a consensus on practice and theology, and they tended to be the mainstream group. Now, some of you may have lived through this division, and you have been called antis, and the article that I sent you is a response by Irvin Lee to this division. And in the course of this division, a lot of people that had been accepted within the broad movement are suddenly now on the outs, and they're not considered to be Christians anymore. And they they're not requested to speak at large meetings. They're not requested to come and preach on a full-time basis for a congregation. This is the development. This is the way that things went. Now, the antis, and that's the group that, frankly, I place myself in. The antis divided into four kind of distinct groups, although there's some overlap here. You had the non-institutional group that said, we're not going to have an institution of any kind. We're not going to even have private colleges soliciting funds from churches. We will have private colleges, but they will be private colleges that solicit funds only from individuals. And then there was a group that focused on not dividing the church into Bible classes. And their rationale was that at no place in the New Testament do you read about the church coming together and then separating into what they call cliques, where you have fifth graders over here and you have sixth graders over here, and the two never talk to each other. They view Bible classes in a very pejorative sense, and they don't divide up into Bible classes. Then there's a group within the Church of Christ, within the Church of Christ wing of the Restoration Movement, that believes that you ought to use one container to take the Lord's Supper. Now, remember I said that sometimes there's some overlap. A lot of the groups that don't divide into classes also use one cup to take the Lord's Supper. So these divisions, distinctions kind of overlap in some ways, but these tend to be the four major groups. And then you had even the smallest group of the four was the mutual edification group, who said that you should not have a located preacher. That all the teaching within the local congregation ought to be done by the elders or the leadership, unpaid. And you may have experienced some of this division yourself. I know that I have. The church where I was preaching at Rose Street in Anchorage came out of the group that was downtown in Anchorage called 10th and B. 10th and B outgrew their building. A group of people went out and started the group on Rose Street. I don't think they were meeting on Rose Street when they first started meeting. They were meeting in somebody's house. And they tended to come down on different, those two groups came down on different sides of the institutional question. They had been together, but when they started the two different groups, the institutional question divided between them, and the group at 10th and B sent a large contingent out to place membership at what was to become Rose Street. They did. That afternoon, they had a meeting, and they locked the doors and wouldn't let the original Rose Street group use the building anymore. So tensions were very high, and that kind of thing happened a lot. Remember, we talked about the Sand Creek debacle, where there was such a division within the church that it went to court to settle who was going to get to keep the asset, and really tends to be the only asset that we have is the building where we meet. And they had a fairly nice building, but you had the Sand Creek debacle, and that's why churches started writing bylaws that prohibited certain things to try to make sure that if this division between the institutional sponsoring church group and the non-sponsoring church group or non-institutional group, if it ever came to a head and the non-institutional group had built the building, they got to keep it. It's a Sand Creek debacle all over again. Anybody gone through those kinds of divisions? I know Ted's probably too young to have gone through that in Anchorage. I think that all happened before Ted. It all happened before I got there, but feelings were really raw when I got there.
Yes, it was before you got there. It was, we had gone through a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Pat, you, or Ann, you were there. You got to go through. Well, you guys came kind of at the tail end of this division,
yeah,
right?
We did, in the beginning, we moved there in the early 60s, in 64, but we were there at 10th and B, and we were there when the other church was established, and it was not pretty. I can tell you that for a fact. It was very heated and very ugly.
And it was a lot.
And I went through the 60s because I was, my mom and I were baptized when I was in my teens. And we went through these two groups in New Mexico, too.
In Kentucky, that all happened kind of, this division happened a little earlier than the 60s.
Yeah, my experience has been that in the lower 48, we were about, 8 to 10 years ahead of Alaska. So Alaska was a little bit behind. So they did it in the 60s, in the early 60s, where about 1955, around the time I was born, actually, because my parents talked a lot about it. They went through it, and things were very, very raw when I was growing up. And my family was divided in this as well.
Yes.
So I had some that went one direction and some that went the other direction, and it caused a lot of friction in families. It was a pretty ugly time.
It really was.
Yeah.
And I think some of the hurt feelings have subsided. But I don't think there will ever be a rapprochement. I don't know that we will continue to say that those folks that stayed with the mainstream group that supported the sponsoring church, I don't know that we're ready to say they're going to hell. But I'm pretty sure that we're also not ready to say, why don't you come and worship here?
Well, in my lifetime, I remember and I don't know if it was an overt teaching or if I just kind of, I don't know how I got there, but I've heard it said that the people in the mainstream group weren't even Christians. And I mean, how harsh is that? They were baptized for the remission of their sins. So we drew lines where I don't think God ever drew lines, but that's just me. But, and there was a lot of hurt. I have enjoyed all four of these sessions because it's so human of us, you know, and there's a lot of hurt all the way around when we go through things like this.
And I think one thing that you see when you've been through this years ago, you can see when it's happening again. You recognize it at different places where you are. And it's sad in a way, because some are so divided. It's so black and white that there is no forgiveness in between.
Right.
And that's what I have a problem with.
Right. Well, I'm going to insert something very personal here. I really admired Cal Hoggard because his, and Anne, correct me if I'm wrong, but his college roommate ended up in Anchorage and on the other side of that divide.
That's
yet
right.
they remained friends and they loved one another through it
and
all.
His wife was like my second mom.
Yeah.
That's how close we were.
You maintain that love and that relationship even through all of those difficult times. And I remember thinking how much I appreciated that, because that wasn't part of my upbringing with even our family members, our close family members. So I always held you and Cal in high regard for that.
Well, thank you.
That's how it should be.
Absolutely.
I remember
we went through that too. The poor all family was all voted out of the church in Fairbanks.
Jim was a preacher. He was in Rose Street for a while.
We started a new congregation in North Pole then.
Well, just one thing I can say is when one of our sons went to Florida College, he called once and was talking and said he was so surprised to find out that there was still what you call blackballing or blackmarking. And I said yes. And he was surprised to find that was still going on, but it still is.
It was. Down there, you were kind of careful. If you didn't just walk up to anybody and say, "Hey, I'm Jim Butterball's sister."
No. And he found out the Hogger name was Barr.
and to be honest, that wasn't the only thing that caused division.
No, it wasn't.
There were divisions that happened later. They may have been about divorce and who was able to remarry and
right.
All of those kinds of things.
That was in our family too.
Yep.
We've been through that too.
Yep, I went through that one. That one got me. That's my division.
Yeah, that was bad for us too when we were in New Mexico and when we were in Alaska. So.
And I think it was bad for the church here at Covert Road. I believe, and now I wish that I had noted this in my prep notes for this. I believe it was B.C. Goodpasture who advocated quarantining the anti-preachers. He was on the mainstream side of this. He was at the time the editor of the Gospel Advocate in Nashville, Tennessee. And he actually wrote an article I shouldn't say that. It may be that he sent a letter to other churches saying that they should quarantine anti-preachers and they should not let them preach there. So, but
for the 60s also, and my uncle was a preacher, and it was really, we were young, of course, but it was awful because some would say, well, we're supposed to take care of our own. So they would adopt the children and bring them home, things like that. But it was really hot and heavy. And being young, you think, well, And finally, I understood, and I have to say, I don't want to be with a sponsoring church because I don't think it's right. But and divorce and remarriage is still hard for a lot of people to get it all, you know.
Yes,
it's there in the scriptures, but they sure have a lot of different interpretations.
Okay, well, we're going to run out of time before I get finished here. Then in the 1970s, you had the development of a group within the mainstream Church of Christ that was focused in Gainesville, Florida, and it came out of the campus ministry of Chuck Lucas, and that should say L-U-C-A-S. He was the preacher at the 14th Street Church of Christ in Gainesville, Florida, that later changed its name to the Crossroads Church of Christ, which is fine. You can call it the Crossroads Church of Christ. But then they tended to drop the Church of Christ, and it became the Crossroads Movement. And this movement focused on personal evangelism. Everybody was expected, and it was a serious expectation that you would bring two people to know Christ every year. And if you didn't, you were called on the carpet. There was an intense religious atmosphere within this group, and that focused on soul talks and prayer partners. Prayer partners got to the point where it was auricular confession. You confessed your sins to your prayer partner never confessed his sins to you. Your prayer partner confessed his sins to his prayer partner. So it was a real hierarchy. That was the problem that people had with it. Then there was a protege of Chuck Lucas named Kip McKean. Kip McKean moved to Boston, and he took this philosophy, started a group in Boston, and interestingly, they didn't have a building. They met in Boston Gardens, which is where the Boston Celtics played basketball. And they would have bigger crowds at their worship services on Sunday mornings than the Boston Celtics were drawing for a basketball game. This was a big deal. In 1993, they changed the name of this group from Crossroads / Boston or Boston Movement or Crossroads Movement. They became the International Church of Christ. And when we were living in Southern California, there was a large movement in Southern California on college campuses to try to convert people. And it was coming from this International Church of Christ. And it had this, the soul talks, the prayer partners, the personal evangelism focus. And it was so bad that you didn't want to say that you were a member of the Church of Christ. You would say, I'm a Christian. But you wouldn't say I'm a member of the Church of Christ because people would immediately assume that you were associated with the International Church of Christ and they didn't want to have anything to do with it. So when the Canyon Church started, they wanted to avoid that and they just called themselves the Canyon Church. And that way they didn't have to deal with people thinking, oh, you're International Church of Christ. So they just became known as the Canyon Church. Okay. That's why they called it Canyon Church. So where are we going to go from here? Well, we'll talk about some of the efforts to bring all of these disparate groups or some of them back together. so that there could be a unified presence. And really, it's the restoration movement playing out all over again. Remember, we started, the problem was there was so much division, and people said that shouldn't be that way. So that's where the restoration movement came from in general in this country. And then there have been movements to try to return to that restoration ideal. There are two kinds of divisive questions that I want to talk about. We'll spend probably next week talking about the unity movements. Then the next 2 weeks, we'll talk about divisive questions that were based on institutions. And the institutions that sort of bubbled to the top were orphans' homes, and they were based largely in Texas. Old folks' homes, I don't know where they were based. I never have read too much about the old folks' homes, but the orphans' homes tended to be based in Texas. Colleges, whether or not colleges should take money from churches or whether colleges could exist taking money only from individuals. We'll talk a little bit about missionary societies and the response to the missionary society from the non-institutional side, the sponsoring church arrangements. Then there were some divisive questions that were based on really hermeneutics, or how should we be viewing the Bible? I've already talked a little bit about historical versus textual criticism, and that sometimes is described as higher versus lower criticism. But we'll talk a little bit about historical and textual criticism. And today, that has kind of morphed into or changed into whether we should view the Bible as a story of God's interaction with man, or whether we should view it as a pattern for man's interaction with God. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then there were divisive questions that were based on largely the silence of the scriptures and the kind of the response to that is a hermeneutic that has been described as command, example, or necessary inference, or CENI. And we'll talk a little bit about the development of those thoughts. Thank you for all of your input tonight. I see that we've run out of time, so bear with me. We'll get to some of these questions. And because these are things that have happened within our lifetime, they will be more meaningful to us. But never forget that many of these things have their genesis all the way back at the beginning with Jonathan Edwards, who wasn't even part of the Restoration Movement. And then it was Thomas and Alexander Campbell and Barton W. Stone. And so we'll talk about all of these things, David Lipscomb, and the preachers who've had such an impact. Is there anything else that we ought to mention before we get away for the evening? And I will send a copy of these slides over to Jerry, and he'll post them on the website. And on top of that, I'll be sending you some articles. I'll try to keep them fairly short. The one that I sent you tonight, I think, was about 16 pages, 17 pages, something like that. Well, it may have been shorter because I reformatted it. I think I got it down to about 11 or 12 pages. So we'll not go through those articles, but they're really good reading. So spend some time reviewing those if you can.